This is Ridgely speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Last time we talked with Steve Coxhead, who's the president of the Indiana Passenger Rail Alliance, it was finding out the latest about Amtrak, whether the Hoosier State line would ever come back or what needs to be done to be able to, the hopes of bringing it back so that passengers can once again travel from even Chicago or certainly Northwest Indiana all the way down to Indianapolis and then to points beyond that. And the question came into Lakeshore Public Radio from a listener, and it was a question off the air, but luckily it got written down. And the question was this: why does it, referring to passenger rail service, work in Europe but not here? And I'm guessing they meant in the United States. Well, we've asked Steve Coxhead to come back with us to talk about this particular topic and anything else we may happen to come up that's new from the last time we spoke. And Steve, thank you for being with us again here on Regionally Speaking.
Chris, thank you for having me once again.
Well, let's jump right into the question at hand here. Why does it, as I guess we're referring to passenger rail service, work in Europe but not here in the United States?
Okay, yeah, very interesting question, Chris. And let me qualify that by saying that if you look at the United States, in the places where we have a well-built-out passenger rail system, particularly what's called the Northeast Corridor, stretching from Washington, D.C. on up to New York and Boston, passenger rail seems to work very well and is very popular. Of course, the one thing that stands out in the Northeast Corridor is that there are many trains. They run frequently. They run when people need to take them, and they go where people want to go. So that being said, what's different about the rest of the U.S. compared to that and also compared to places like Europe? And I think you have to go back in history. You go back to around 1948, 1950, and at that time the U.S. had one of the best passenger rail systems in the world, and the major railroads were spending a huge amount of money repairing, re-equipping, rehabilitating their equipment and their operations in the wake of the Second World War. Over in Europe, you had a rail system which was pretty much worn out because of the requirements of the war, and also they'd been bombed and everything else. So they started kind of at a lower base than we did. Now, what you saw throughout the end of the 40s into the 50s and 60s is that in the United States, we basically let the rail system, particularly the passenger part of it, fend for itself and expected it to take care of all its own needs. While that was going on, the federal government primarily and also some of the states put billions of tax dollars into improving the highway system, primarily interstates and expressways, and building out and improving the air transport system. So essentially building a huge amount of competition for the railroads. Now, and partly as a result of the change in where manufacturing was done in this country and what we manufactured, you had railroads losing business. It wasn't just passenger, it was freight business also in the northeastern quarter of the country. To the point where about 1970, every major railroad in the northeastern United States was either bankrupt or verging on it. And it wasn't just a passenger rail problem. They were losing money on freight, too. So you had a situation where for 20, 30 years, by federal policy, we had pretty much neglected our railroad system, whereas we'd energetically built up its competitors, ground transportation with expressways, the interstate highway system, and the air transport system. Basically, airports, traffic control system, and so forth were built with government money. Now, by contrast, what were they doing over in Europe? In Europe, they were also repairing and building out their highway system. You had your autobahns in Germany, and you had your motorways in Britain and expressways in France and other places. They were also building out their air networks covering Western Europe. But they were also repairing and rebuilding their rail systems, bringing them into the modern age. So on the one hand, you had the U.S., where the rail systems were basically left to wander off by themselves. In Europe, by government policy, the rail systems were viewed as an important part of the national transportation infrastructure, and they were brought up to date. Now, of course, in Europe, basically the rail systems were, at one point or another, and some of them still are, basically national enterprises. That is to say, they were, nationalized at some point. The United Kingdom even had a very interesting situation where you had a series of private railroads, and after the Second World War, they were nationalized into British Rail, and then they were reprivatized in the 70s and 80s. So now you have an interesting situation in Britain where the physical plant, the rails themselves, mm-hmm. are owned by one government company, and then you have private operators competing to supply the service on those rails. You have a similar situation in France where you have private companies competing to operate the passenger service, whereas the basic infrastructure was financed and built by the government. So I would say the big difference between this country and Europe is the degree of importance placed on the rail transport system by the national government. Okay. People generally do not ride trains in this country outside the Northeast Corridor. Why is that? It's because there are very few trains. The trains don't go where people want to go. They don't go at times, where people want to go. And the service is, in many cases, relatively poor. For instance, I've noted and others have noted, that there's a lot of traffic back and forth between Northwest Indiana and the Chicago area and Indianapolis and further south into Cincinnati. How do you get down there? Well, basically, you have to drive, get in your own car and drive. It's difficult to fly from Northwest Indiana, for instance, to Indianapolis. You have to go into Chicago and catch a flight and then fly back. Your only other alternative really is to drive down, and that's because there are no trains. Our organization likes to answer, and people say, well, why don't people ride the trains? Our answer is because the trains aren't there. For instance, the South Shore Railroad, which links Chicago, Northwest Indiana, and finally out to South Bend, I think has 8 round trips a day during the weekday, normally. Mm-hmm. The Hoosier State, when it was running, had 1 round trip 4 days a week. Now consider the situation. If you had 9 round trips a day between Northwest Indiana and Indianapolis, you may get a fair amount of riders on that, because people would find that the train was going when they wanted to go and where they wanted to go. So I guess it's kind of a long way of saying that passenger rail does not appear to work in this country. Because over a long period of time, through our federal government, we have put in place policies that basically make it not work, whereas we've had other policies that favor their direct competition, improve roads and air passenger transport. And, of course, now we get to the situation where in Indiana, at least, I believe in other states, we're having trouble raising enough money through taxes to keep our road system in repair, and we see that the airlines are in fact abandoning service in many smaller communities. I think places like Detroit, like Cincinnati, like St. Louis have lost flights over time. Indianapolis struggles to maintain enough flights to justify its international airport. And so the airlines themselves are retrenching, back into long-distance routes built around major hubs. Here again, throwing the traveling public for internal transportation, and in our case, let's say within Indiana and the surrounding states, we pretty much have to get in the car and drive because we have no alternative. So that, I think, is the situation. It may be kind of a counterintuitive situation, and the reasons for the U.S. adopting a kind of unfriendly policy to rail transport that, you know, it really ties in with 40 years of U.S. politics, and we could go on all night about that. Basically, you know, the railroads, even though they had performed yeoman service in getting us through the Second World War, were basically unpopular into the 40s and 50s, and trains and automobiles were considered new and exciting. Railroads were private industry. It was the government building the roads and setting up the air transport system. So the railroads were still treated as a major player with strong competition and having enough market power that they had to be watched. As we got into the 40s and the 50s and to about 1960, that was not the case. So that's basically what happened. Up to the into the late 60s, when it became apparent something had to be done, probably the most effective way to at least solve the passenger rail situation would have been to simply subsidize the railroads that had that carried passengers to allow passenger service to remain viable. Now, at this point, it wasn't just the fact that you had book losses possibly in passenger service, but the railroads were having trouble maintaining their physical plant. You had the rails deteriorating to the point where you couldn't maintain a fast schedule, you couldn't maintain a schedule at all in some places. You had, in some cases, what were called standing derailments, where an engine standing in the yard would simply fall off the tracks. Okay, now this affected the railroad's ability to run a passenger service. It affected the railroad's ability to carry the mail. And that was the situation in the late 60s when Amtrak came along. Now, the federal government's solution was not to nationalize the rails. It was not to subsidize the rails. What they essentially did was to nationalize the railroads in the northeast quadrant of the United States. The major railroads were all absorbed into an entity called Conrail, which was given the mandate to provide freight service to the northeastern United States. And Conrail was given the guidance, the management, and the funding to actually rationalize that service. And it got to the point where eventually Conrail was actually doing so well that it became an attractive target for purchase and was sold off in pieces to Norfolk Southern and CSX. On the other hand, that was just the Northeast U.S.
Right.
On the other hand, the passenger service nationally was nationalized with the passenger service from almost every railroad in the country. There were a few holdouts, I think Southern and Santa Fe did not join right away because they were proud of their passenger service. So Amtrak basically was a device for nationalizing rail passenger service nationwide. Now, as opposed to Conrail, Amtrak, many of us who followed these things would maintain, was never given the mandate, the management, or the funding to bring the passenger side of rail service in the U.S. into a state of good repair and bring it up to world-class standards. So on the one hand, you had the Conrail example in the northeastern U.S. in which the federal government took it over and brought it up to first-class standards. The passenger side, the federal government took it over and basically just kind of let it limp along. Many people, and I think with reason, and this goes back to statements that some people in the Nixon administration, for instance, made, believe that the purpose of Amtrak was what we call stealth abandonment, that you take all the passenger service and sweep it into this thing called Amtrak, you starve Amtrak for resources and leadership, and you basically make it appear that no one wants to ride the passenger trains, and then they go away. Well, it didn't happen. And it didn't happen because there is an underlying need for rail passenger service in this country that was and possibly is to this day greater than many people understand. And so Amtrak was forced to limp along because many people found that they did want to use passenger trains. They did want it to work. And they forced the federal government Congress after Congress to continue to fund it. The problem is Amtrak today, and here again, this is opinion, but I think it's opinion shared by many of us who have paid attention to what's happening with passenger rail. Amtrak has never really been given a mandate to provide the United States with a world-class national passenger rail service. And that includes a lack of funding. It includes a lack of oversight on the part of the federal government. If you take a look at the history of Amtrak, you see that there's really been no entity within the federal government, neither congressional nor executive branch, who's really taken it as their responsibility to make sure that we have a world-class system. We can do a world-class system. I think people would maintain that, for instance, our military is a world-class military. We just decided not to do that with Amtrak. And here again, to really thoroughly go into the reasons behind that, you have to get into the politics of several states and both parties and many powerful individuals. So basically, it's gotten bogged down in U.S. politics. And you start from a point around 1950 when there was no national dedication to providing world-class passenger service. And it just kind of has limped along since then. And I think that, in a nutshell, is it, Chris. I'm not sure how much further we could go without
boring your listeners
for the rest of the day.
Well, we've answered the question completely. I would say we've come full circle now in asking the question, which started out was, why does it, referring to the passenger rail service in the United States, or I should say, why does the passenger rail service in general work in Europe, but not here in the United States? And it obviously appears that in Europe, they chose after the war to rebuild, because they had to rebuild so much other infrastructure after the fighting and the bombing of cities and the like. And obviously, it was just not the case for the United States. They let certain areas stay well, but they didn't take care of all the country, which they apparently should have to begin with. And that brings us even to now, with the fact that the situation with the Hoosier State and even the Cardinal Service, which is the only of the two that run through Indiana these days. It just needs the help to be beefed back up and put back into service again. And it's up to certain individuals and organizations to decide to do so. So, Steve, I think we've got complete answer on the one question, to be sure. And I know there'll be updates to come in on the other questions too. And we will get back together again. We'll talk about that then. Thank you very much for spending some time with us today.
Be happy to do so. And thank you very much, Chris.
Thank you very much, Steve. Steve Coxhead is the president of the Indiana Passenger Rail Alliance. And you're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. This next story comes to you from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. The Welcome Project collects first-person stories and pairs these with intentional conversations to help forge stronger ties within and across our communities.
My role here as a security guard, coming from a school where it's 1,400 students to just 600 students, I get a lot more one-on-one with a lot of kids. A lot of these kids here are raised by single parents, or they're special needs students, or have some type of emotional history in their lives. I have to make a different transition almost every day here. I can't just come in thinking as a police officer, because I can have a student having problems at home and come here and flies off at the handle. As a police officer, somebody gets irate and being disorderly, is immediately lock them up, handcuff them, take them to jail if you can't get them to get under control. Here, it's the total opposite. It's like, come on, talk to me. Tell me what's going on with you and what's going on in your life today. Yes, I'm a security guard here. Yes, I'm a police officer and I do it, but I'm more now of a mentor slash counselor. And that sometimes I'm a disciplinarian. I do things like what the principal would do, give them detention on Saturdays if they don't do right. And we do a lot of timeout things where we bring them in and talk to them and let them calm down before we take them back to class. So it's not automatically jail or suspension like at some of the other schools that I've known. I started a mentoring program here for the high school boys because there's a lot of them that don't understand how to become a man or what to portray as a young man coming into adulthood. The first day we had the meeting, I asked them, do they see themselves graduating? And a lot of them's like, no. Do you see yourself becoming 21? A lot of them was like, no. And I was like, why? And they said, because what is there for them to do? What is life? Now, you know, I got a lot of them that have joined the military. So they saw that as another out. Joined the Marines, joined the Army and the Navy. They seen that it's something more to life than just being in the streets. I even have one kid now. We sat there and we talked how he, as a youngster, stayed in and out of trouble, being suspended, ended up going to jail. Once I sat down and talked to him earlier this year, now he done made his transition, made his decision to do what he needs to do, and he got his grades. Took his GPA up to a 3.5. He wants to go off to college. And I know from my history as an officer, you're going to have those that you're going to lose no matter what. It's going to impact you, and it has impacted me sometimes because, you know, I've seen some that I coached and mentored and that's no longer here, you know, that's been killed. It affects me a lot because I have to ask myself, did I really give this person the right amount of time to try to do what needs to be done to get themselves right? Yes, he trusted me and embedded me, but when he leaves here, did he keep it in mind? Do we get that same reinforcement at home? If not, did I do enough to keep on him every day? Yeah, it hurts, and it's gonna always hurt, but I can't dwell on it because it might be three or four other ones that look at me and say, oh, if he gives up, I'll give up too. So I can't do that. I have to do it amongst closed doors and then just keep pushing and keep driving because I don't know who's watching me. I don't know which kid got his eye on me, which kid is really looking up to me, trying to wear the shoes I'm wearing. Who knows, we might have the next president or whoever that's walking through these buildings now as a student who has that aspiration. But if we don't put the work in to help them to see that or to pursue their vision, what's going to happen next? That'd be another person that we'd lose to the streets.
You can find more regional stories online at welcomeproject.valpo.edu. Girls on the Run in Northwest Indiana is getting ready to go into its 27th season, and unfortunately it's in the midst of a pandemic. What is Girls on the Run of Northwest Indiana? Well, we have the executive director of the organization, Jill Schluter-Kim, with us to talk about it. And Jill, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Oh, thank you, Chris. So happy to be here with you.
Well, first, take some time, if you will, for people that are not familiar with Girls on the Run, the organization is, in particular, here in Northwest Indiana. Tell us more about it.
Yeah, so actually, I started the program here 13 years ago in 2007. It's a national program that I learned about from reading about it in Runner's World magazine, and I was just really enticed by it, so brought it here to start our local council, Girls on the Run of Northwest Indiana. I loved the way it combined kind of my passions of social work and running and raising strong, powerful girls into one big program. So that really enticed me. So we started out pretty small with one team of 15 girls. And over the years, we've served over 15,000 girls. As we've grown and grown, we now serve 10 counties in Northwest Indiana. But what the program is, it's an after-school program for girls in 3rd through 8th grade, and it's really a girls' empowerment program. It's called Girls on the Run, but we really just use the running portion to get our lessons across. So the girls meet for 10 weeks. Twice a week with trained coaches to learn lessons about life, things like that build confidence and empathy in girls. They just really learn we really encourage them to be their strongest, like, individual selves and think about what they value and to be, you know, strong enough to kind of stand up for their individuality. And they also learn to be part of a group, learn great social skills, and they also learn about what it means to be part of their community and how to give back to their communities. In fact, we incorporate a community service project into the 10-week program.
Mm-hmm.
And through all this, we play fun games, and they do a lot of running activities, and they train to run or walk or roll 5K.
Mm-hmm.
So by the end of the season, they all come together throughout Northwest Indiana to do a celebratory 5K together.
That's great. That's great. Now, in years past, before the pandemic hit and messed everything up, what kind of service projects have the girls been involved in?
Oh, you know, they choose what they want to do. So they when they think about what communities they're a part of, they kind of go through a list and, you know, brainstorm. And then it's simple projects because they need to get them done during their lessons. But they've done things like food drives. A lot of them like to do things for the Humane Society or other shelters. So collecting like pet supplies to donate. But they've also done things like clean up the schoolyard, pick up trash, plant plants to make their schools prettier, write letters to servicemen and women overseas, make blankets. We've had some like flooding in the past and events like that. They've made blankets for people impacted by things like that, all kinds of things. Going to, you know, support their local police or fire departments by making them snacks or writing them letters. Just about anything you can imagine. They've come up with some really creative ideas.
We're talking with Jill Schluter Kim, who is the executive director of Girls on the Run in Northwest Indiana, going into the 27th season. Now, Jill, when the pandemic hit and things had to close the schools and all earlier this year, you probably got a clue that things were going to be not the same, and especially as the closer we got into fall when we started to get programs together. What type of programs and how have you been able to be able to do them, or going to be able to do them, I should say, as we go into the fall months here because of the coronavirus pandemic?
Yeah, going into the fall, we are definitely, you know, our main goal was to be able to continue to pursue our mission and really serve the girls. We feel like right now our girls need this program more than ever. They're more isolated. They're dealing with so many different kinds of stress and all this information, all this news coming at them. So, you know, one thing we really talk about in Girls on the Run is how to express your emotions, how to deal with the emotions. And we know girls need that now. And then also making connections with other girls. We know that's really important because a lot of them have been pretty isolated for the past few months. So what we're able to do right now, and, you know, I'll definitely give credit to Girls on the Run International, who have really been creative and responsive to everything that's happened. We are able to deliver our lessons really in three different ways.
Okay.
One is in person. We still do have some in-person sites. Typically, we're at schools, but we've gotten creative with that. We're at several different parks in the region. And actually, one person is hosting a site at their home. So that's a new one for us. But we also have some virtual teams signed up as well. So we've got some girls doing the program all online. It's basically the same curriculum as we are delivering in person, just slightly modified. And then we're able to also, if our in-person teams need to move to online, we are able to easily transition the teams to an online format as well.
Are you finding that although the program has always been there to be able to nurture physical and emotional health all through the time that the Girls on the Run has been in existence, do you find that the extra help is really, really needed now and it's going to make it more difficult in some ways to be able to get the lessons through? But just the same, you're working toward that goal still, aren't you?
We are still working towards that goal. And, yeah, we do feel like the girls really need it now. You know, just thinking about the impact of trauma on children as they become adults. We all know from, you know, thinking about ACEs, adverse childhood experiences, and the impact of trauma that, you know, we're all going through a collective time of trauma right now. So we don't know what this can look like for our children, you know, as they become adults. So our goal is to really, we really want to make sure that we can serve as many girls as we can and help them through that trauma. You know, this fall, our season's a little bit smaller, but we're hoping in the spring that we can, we typically have a very, very large spring season where we serve about 1,400 girls.
Oh.
So we're hoping to get back to, if not that many, at least a larger amount of girls to start working on that. We really feel like it's going to be, you know, helpful for girls to be able to connect with others and talk out their feelings and learn about, you know, really expressing their emotions.
Now, registration's open right now. How can family members and girls get signed up for the organization this time?
It is. Our season is starting this week, but girls can still register. They can go to our website. It's www.gotrofnwi, so Girls on the Run of Northwest Indiana.org. We do still have some openings at some of our parks, including Reeder Park, Wicker Park, and Lemon Lake. And we do have openings on our virtual teams. We have Girls on the Run teams that are still open virtually. One is being led by our sorority philanthropic partner, Gamma Phi Beta, at Valparaiso University. So that's a super fun one to be hanging out with some sorority girls for our third through fifth graders. That's a lot of fun. And then we also have a Heart and Soul team, which is our middle school program. So sixth through eighth grade, we've got some awesome coaches for that as well, and that's a virtual team. But our other teams are full, but we still have some openings, and they can sign up today.
Josh Luter Kim is Executive Director of Girls on the Run in Northwest Indiana, and thank you very much for being with us, telling us about the organization. And even though the coronavirus pandemic has kind of messed up the traditional season, you're still planning one to keep the girls occupied and help them not only be safe, but also help enrich their lives as well, too. Thank you for being with us to talk about it.
Thank you so much, Chris. I appreciate it.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. We'll be back with you with Regionally Speaking tomorrow.